evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Earlier today, President Trump gave what he called an update regarding the crisis on our southern border. And for some analysis on his speech, let's turn to my first guest. He heads the law firm of Garcia and Garcia's San Antonio, Texas office. He has specialized in immigration law his entire professional career. He is Carlos Castaneda. Carlos, as always, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure.
Carlos, I know you sat and you listened to this. The president went through some of his usual tropes. Talk a little bit about, for example, his telling us about the threat. He claims that there are now 20 million to 30 million immigrants living in the country illegally because previous administrations had released immigrants back into the U.S. community. So he's talking about the so-called catch and release program.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start with this. The so-called catch and release program is actually just, how should I say this, a political term of art, because I've seen it used and abused and misused so often such that it has no longer any meaning. Now, that's my point of view as a lawyer. Now, the second aspect of that is illegal immigrants, 20 to 30 million, according to what the president said. To be honest with you, I have started to ignore most of what the president said when it comes to immigration law. I keep my close ear to the ground, but the things that, as an attorney, I often look at is what Jeff Sessions says more than Donald Trump.
Great point.
Why? Is because the Attorney General of the United States has a very, very strong impact over immigration law because the immigration courts of the United States are part of the Department of Justice, and the immigration agencies, most of which are part of the Department of Homeland Security, often take their cue from what the Attorney General is doing. And let me tell you, it feels that every 2 months or so, there is a very significant change in immigration practice because of the very concerted, very strategic efforts of Mr. Jeff Sessions. Going back to what the president said, though, as to 20 or 30 million people living here, my last memory as to estimates of undocumented immigrants in the United States is about 11 to 12 million people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not someone that focuses on the census or what have you, so I couldn't give you a more independent view. But the 20 and 30 million, I really think that that's just a number he picked out of the blue.
And it's interesting because your research is consistent with mine. And if there were 30 million immigrants living in the country illegally, and he says because previous administrations had released immigrants back into the U.S., he's talking about almost 10% of the population.
Indeed, indeed. And that's just one indication that this is one of those other lies, quite frankly, by the president. And again, this is why me, as an immigration practitioner, I actually have to make a concerted effort to not so much, pretty much ignore what the president says, or take it with a great bit of salt, because I have clients who then come to me asking, worried about this. And I have to explain to them the difference between political bluster and actual law.
But isn't Jeff Sessions taking his cue from the president, isn't the attorney general implementing, at least from a direction perspective, the issues and interests of the president?
It's very interesting that you say that because actually my view is actually in the reverse. The president is taking his cue from Sessions.
Okay, all right.
Decades has been a hard line against legal and illegal immigration in many sense.
Okay.
What he's doing is not a surprise to me at all.
Okay.
It's worrisome to me that someone so savvy when it comes to law has taken the reins of power and is using that power effectively. Donald Trump, I don't really think he cares that much about immigration. He cares about what makes him popular. And when it comes to the GOP base, I've seen that make him very popular. When it comes to pleasing one of his earliest and indeed important supporters, which is Jeff Sessions, that is something that makes him popular, and he rolls with what makes him feel that he's being paid attention to, which is why it was frustrating for me, and yet not all that surprising in the big scheme of things, to hear how earlier this week, as I'm sure you know, he said that he would, via executive order, essentially revoke part of the Constitution, and I'm referring to the 14th Amendment, how if you're born in the United States, you are, by that nature, a U.S. citizen.
Let me quickly, we have just about 2 minutes left. The president said, illegal immigration affects the life of all Americans. Illegal immigration hurts American workers, burdens American taxpayers, and undermines public safety and places enormous strain on our local schools, hospitals, and communities in general, taking precious resources from poor Americans who need them most. A couple of things. Illegal immigration hurts American workers. That's a standard political trope that is used. That point has been disproven. The data is very clear about the positive impact that immigrants have on our economy as opposed to the negative impacts. Undermining public safety. Data shows that immigrants are less likely to commit crime than others in this country. And so he just seems to be playing to some very, very racist, anti-immigrant tropes and themes that just get repeated and repeated and repeated ad nauseum.
And what me was frustrating is that, to a certain extent, it is being effective in an electoral sense. And though I have my own views on all this matter, I can say that in my part of the country, I do see a little bit of effectiveness. I see the base being riled up. And I see more than anything concern in my clients, concern as to what happens next. And there have been people, more than a few, in which I have to say their outlook, their ability to get legal status through lawful means has been reduced, their chances of getting it has been reduced, if not cut off entirely, because of changes that have occurred in just the last year. And I thank not the president for that, but Jeff Sessions for that. And by thank, I obviously mean criticize.
Have you heard Sessions comment on the president's 14th Amendment claim? I've heard Mike Pence try to rationalize it. I've heard others, but I haven't heard Sessions on that point.
To be honest with you, I have not looked into that. I generally allow the news to filter through and focus on whatever new guidance document or maybe policy memorandum is issued by the Attorney General's office or the DHS. What I can tell you is this. What the president could do is not amend the Constitution by any means, but what he actually has already begun to do, and I've seen this at the Department of State level, is people are, in the Department of State, are giving individuals a hard time who have birth certificates from areas near the border. They are alleging that, oh, maybe this birth certificate is not legit.
Yes, they're making it more difficult. The paperwork and the red tape is becoming more difficult to go through. Carlos Castaneda from Garcia and Garcia, he heads their San Antonio law office. Carlos, thank you so much, as always, for your time. Greatly appreciate you coming on the Critical Hour.
No worries. I'm here for you.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate that. I'll tell you, folks, take some time, listen to some of this speech. It is a bit hard to get through, but it is what it is. You are listening to the Critical Hour here. I got to give a big shout out to my Facebook fans. Thank you, as always, for tuning in and watching. And thank you all for the love that you show. And we try to respond to as many of you as we possibly can. You are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. President Trump has reportedly tapped State Department spokesperson and former Fox News journalist Heather Nauert as his pick to replace outgoing U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Also, National Security Advisor John Bolton gave a modern-day Axis of Evil speech earlier today. This one focused on three countries in Latin America. In a 30-minute address at Miami-Dade College's Freedom Tower, of all places, Bolton said the Trump administration will take a hard line against Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua by sanctioning the countries and cutting off diplomatic relations with them until they meet U.S. demands. What does this say about Trump administration direction in foreign policy? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to quote Bolton here. This troika of tyranny, this triangle of terror stretching from Havana to Caracas to Managua, is the cause of immense human suffering, the impetus of enormous regional instability, and the genesis of a sordid cradle of communism in the Western Hemisphere. He continued, under President Trump, the United States is taking direct action against all three regimes to defend the rule of law, liberty, and basic human decency in our region, end quote. Daniel, this is pretty strong language targeted at three democracies in Latin America. What's going on?
Well, I think his language is really borders on the Hitlerian. I mean, I really hate to invoke Hitler because he's so often over invoked. But this language just completely departs from reality. It's just a language of naked aggression, and it's just leading in ever more dangerous directions.
He used troika of tyranny, and I would have thought in a description such as this that triumvirate would have been the word. Why do you think he used troika? First of all, am I right that triumvirate would have been the better word?
Well, triumvirate, yeah.
Yes, triumvirate.
I mean, triumvirate was a three-man leadership or imperial leadership. So yeah, so a triumvirate would be the more appropriate term. A troika is a three-horse Russian sleigh.
Right.
Khrushchev, you made the term famous back in the 1960s. But I don't know. I mean, you know, Bolton likes alliteration, so he's going for troika rather than triumvirate. He probably thinks it sounds cooler. But it's just really nasty, over the top stuff. And the Trump administration is really captured by this logic of aggression, and it's just pursuing it ever more aggressively.
It seems to be just unnecessarily bellicose and unnecessarily jingoistic. He says, this is not a time to back away. It's a time to increase the pressure, not reduce it. What is this sense of urgency?
Well, I mean, I think Trump is his attitudes are increasingly bellicose. I mean, to him, you think it's unnecessary. But he thinks it's necessary to be ever more bellicose, to go searching the globe for enemies, and to sort of like, you know, adopt a free form policy of aggression. So now he's settling on these three countries. They're very different countries, and it's all ridiculous. And he's making some of the, you know, I mean, the situation in Venezuela is very bad, but Trump is making it much worse. He's compounding that country's problems. And the only thing he has to offer the Venezuelans will be more economic setbacks, more economic contraction, and more poverty. That's all he stands for.
Is this the Reagan fear, you know, of communism? Is this that old trope of the communists are taking over Latin America and therefore we must stand against them at every turn? Is that what's behind, or is this, as China is making its way into other regions of the world, that this is really a message to China that they're using these three countries to send?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, first of all, when Reagan got really heavily into Cold War II, the left had been making dramatic advances in the 1970s and 80s. So Reagan saw that as a threat. And therefore, he took action. Now, the left has been the, I mean, communism is a spent force in Latin America. It's been a spent force for 30 years, for good or for ill, for good or for bad. And it just goes to show that, that despite the removal of the so-called communist threat, Trump just is becoming more aggressive. Rather than less, he's not responding to any dangers. He's just like he is embarking on a policy of aggression for its own sake, and he is pulling out all the stops, and he is turning the heat on, and it's going to get worse and worse until something happens, something really bad happens. Either he stops, or he stumbles into a really nasty war.
A policy of aggression for its own sake. That there, I think, is a very apt and clear description of what it is that we're seeing from the United States in this region.
Yeah, I think it's that's what's happening. It's aggression feeding on itself. And the more it goes unchecked, the stronger and more powerful it becomes. Trump is searching for enemies. He's looking for a fight. So far, no one is giving him one. But that very fact makes him look all the harder and behave all the more aggressively.
Your thoughts on Heather Nauert as his pick to replace outgoing U.S. Ambassador to the United States, Nikki Haley, and is this selection of Nauert consistent with Bolton's bellicose language?
Well, I said it seems to be. She seems to be very much in his mold, but in Bolton's mold. But I don't really know whether she just, you know, whether she really believes this stuff, or she's simply a careerist who is wants to see her name in the headlines. And Trump certainly likes attractive blondes, and that's what she is. So that's probably the main reason why he chose her. It's just another sort of like empty seat. Prattling on this kind of Trumpian aggressive nonsense.
But as a careerist without, say, an agenda or a substantive worldview, then one would only think that Heather Nauert becomes the necessary mouthpiece in the United Nations to carry forth the agenda that Bolton, Pompeo, and Trump want to put on the table.
Yes, absolutely. But she is merely a mouthpiece. I don't think she is in any way
an ideologue.
In her own right. But Bolton is, and Pompeo is also. But Bolton especially. Bolton's a very strong figure, a man of very pronounced extreme neocon views, and he seems to have captured Trump's imagination. So Trump likes him. Trump is giving him free rein, and the result is an ever more aggressive U.S. foreign policy, but one which is increasingly unhinged. As I said, it's just simply aggression for aggression's sake. So therefore, there's no reason behind this other than simply engaging in a increasingly offensive and dangerous activity.
No, there is a reason, and there is a very clear reason, and that is Lockheed Martin, that is Boeing, and the other defense manufacturers and their need to sell weaponry.
That's certainly true.
Dollar signs and profit from sole source government contracts, Tomahawk cruise missiles, and all the accoutrements that come with them.
Absolutely. And now that Saudi Arabia is circling the drain, Trump is looking for new markets. But Bolsonaro's election in Brazil means that Venezuela is essentially surrounded on two sides by hostile right-wing governments, also Colombia as well. And there is a significant danger of some kind of military action taking place.
So Vice President Pence goes to the region about 2 months ago and I think lays a lot of the framework that Bolton is now trying to build upon.
Yeah. And Bolsonaro's victory in Brazil is very important. Trump and Bolton are very pleased by that victory. Bolsonaro is a far right wing figure. I think the word fascist is not inappropriate in his case. So it shows the dangerous new turn that U.S. policy is taking in that region.
And Steve Bannon was part of Bolsonaro's advisory committee, And many have said that Bolsonaro is more Trump than Trump.
Bolsonaro makes Donald Trump look like Elizabeth Warren, but Trump is moving in Bolsonaro's direction. I think the tendencies towards aggression, authoritarianism, etc., are all they're intensifying. We'll see what happens next week with the election.
You said that Trump is moving in Bolsonaro's direction. Many would have said Bolsonaro is moving in Trump's direction and that Steve Bannon is directing it.
Well, let's just say there's a convergence here.
Okay.
But certainly Bolsonaro certainly.
He's been in the game. He's been in the game a lot longer. Bolsonaro has been in the game a lot longer, and he's been spewing this hateful, racist, xenophobic, anti-gay rhetoric a lot longer. So I guess you're right. Trump has been moving in Bolsonaro's direction.
And as bad as Trump is, Bolsonaro's rhetoric is much
worse,
extreme, much more raw. I mean, this guy is really a dangerous character. Not that Trump isn't, but Bolsonaro is even more extreme than Trump. So I think that Bolsonaro's victory essentially sends a message to Trump that this kind of right-wing authoritarianism pays off. And so therefore Trump says, I think I will follow Bolsonaro's playbook for a while and see where it leads. And this is how I interpret Bolton's rhetoric these days. And Bolton really sees an opening for an increasingly right-wing policy with regard to Latin America. He's targeting these three countries virtually at random, but he wants an increasingly aggressive, bellicose U.S. policy in that region, and it looks like he's going to get it.
And don't we also see this playing itself out in countries in Europe? This right wing, authoritarian neocon. We see it in Austria. We see it playing itself out, developing and being on the rise in a number of European countries. And then you've got Stephen King, who was in Europe telling people you can't build your cultures on the backs of other people's babies, and using that type of rhetoric to convey a Trumpian message.
Yes. I mean, I think in Europe, we've seen these kind of tendencies in Poland, Hungary, Italy, especially these days, and yes, this kind of increasingly bold, aggressive authoritarianism seems to be coming on really strong. There's a real wave building, and it's evident across broad regions of the world. That seems to be the new style of governance of the late 2010s.
And do you also see austerity measures being the imposition of austerity measures or being suggested and trying to be implemented in some of these countries, like Venezuela and Nicaragua?
Yes, I do. Venezuela, by the way, is a country in deep, deep trouble. A little while ago, you called Venezuela a democracy. Venezuela is a country which is really, really failing rapidly, and the Maduro government is a big part of the problem. I'm not trying to side with Trump by any means, but that society is really in a state of collapse. But Nicaragua is a different story, and Cuba is a different story, an entirely different story. But these are countries that are having problems, and they therefore represent what Bolton thinks are easy targets. So therefore, he's going after them. He wants to, he thinks they'll fall easily. I'm not so sure how true that is.
But is this also a part of an ongoing image in the minds of imperial powers? They hate resistance. They always want to be sure that countries that pushed back against the imperial power eventually pay the price.
Yes, America has a very long memory. We've seen that. And America always exacts its revenge. What do they say about the Serbs? It forgives, but it never forgets.
Right.
And the case with Muammar Gaddafi was a perfect case.
And Haiti.
Relations between Haiti as well, but But like, you know, in the case of Gaddafi, I mean, the relations between the U.S. And Libya had improved at various points. But when the U.S. had an opportunity to really knife Gaddafi, it seized that opportunity. And the same thing with Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua has had difficult relations with the U.S., but one would have thought the enmity of the 1980s had died down. But the U.S. now sees an opportunity to get back at Nicaragua's leadership and Daniel Ortega, and it looks like it's going to do it because it's aiming for a Libyan solution. Won't be happy until Ortega is somehow, killed and lynched by a mob. So the U.S. is increasingly aggressive, increasingly ferocious in its rhetoric, and it seems to be heating up. I don't see any end in sight. All I see is it's ever more aggressive action on the part of the Trump administration. But much depends on next week's election. We'll see how Trump does, and whether his power is strengthened or weakened.
Daniel Lazar, as always, I greatly appreciate your input, and you're always so gracious with your time when we call you to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. CIA coder charged in WikiLeaks dump claims he's being tortured in jail. In a letter to U.S. District Judge Paul Crotty of the Southern District of New York, Joshua Adam Schulte says his stint in solitary confinement constitutes, quote, cruel and unusual punishment, end quote, and has interfered with his legal battle. To get insight into this story, we turn to my next guest. He leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the World, a publishing arm for the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. He served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush, and he co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose how intelligence has been falsified to, quote-unquote, justify war in Iraq. He is Ray McGovern. And Ray, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. It's good to be with you.
So Joshua Adam Schulte, 30 years old, was charged last June under the Espionage Act for allegedly leaking the trove of 8,000 CIA files that WikiLeaks published last year under the rubric Vault 7. Now, Schulte says his stint in solitary confinement constitutes, quote, cruel and unusual punishment, end quote, and has interfered with his legal battle. When you and I spoke earlier today, you said this was a really big story. Why?
Well, it's a big story because of Vault 7. Now, many of your listeners will never have heard of Vault 7, and that's because it was poison once it was announced by WikiLeaks that the United States, in the person of John Brennan, head of the CIA, had developed a array of cyber offensive tools that were really earth-shattering in their effect. Let me explain. On March 7th, 2017, WikiLeaks made its first announcement saying that it had a treasure trove of documents showing cyber tools developed by the CIA, a particular directorate that John Brennan had set up 3 years before, and that they were capable of doing all manner of things. For example, as the New York Times reported, they could take control of your car and make your car go 100 miles an hour or more without the brakes working. That can kill people. And there is active speculation that has already been done to a reporter. The other thing was they could they could put into a Korean, South Korean-made TV software that would let the TV monitor everything that went on in your apartment or your home or your bedroom with it being turned off to all intents and purposes. In other words, the monitor audio would get you anyway, even if you turned it off. Now, that was, they made some pretty good news, and the Washington Post and New York Times all carried that, Baltimore Sun. But then on the 31st of March, so what, two, 3 weeks later, again, last year, WikiLeaks released a explanation of a tool, a cyber tool, offensive cyber tool called Marble Framework. Now, this is probably interesting to you. I got a call from RT at about 7:30 that morning. The story had broken about an hour before. RT has never called me at 7:30 in the morning, never before 11, even if they're asking me for that day. So I said, well, what are you waking me up for? And RT says, oh, there's a big story. We just sent you a link. Take a look at the link, and if you could come in, it would be great. And I looked at the link, and I said, wow. Here was a tool that allowed the CIA to crack into computer or servers, hack is the word I suppose you should use, to obfuscate is the word CIA use, something we used to use these big words, we got a dictionary, right? Okay, obfuscate, in other words, disguise who hacked in and actually leave telltale signs, like Cyrillic, Russian language, to attribute the hack to another country or another intelligence service. That this tool had been used in 2016, and that now it was revealed for all its glory. And when I saw that, I said, well, I have to come in now. How soon do you need me? I said, 9 o'clock. I said, wait a second. RT, you're not even open at 9 o'clock in Washington. That's okay. Eurovision is going to host you, and we need you coming right away. So here's McGovern, gets in his car, goes down the carpool-only lanes, right, devotion to duty here, and then he thinks, well, what am I going to say? And so he calls Bill Binney, who is technical director of the National Security Agency, and I said, Bill, what do I say? And Bill said, say this, Ray, I was there. I, Bill Binney, was there when these things were being developed in coordination with the CIA. Most of the expertise was at NSA, and this is what allows you to do. I should say, first off, and you should say, Ray, that it involves, get this, Ray, 700 million lines of code. Now, McGovern is the, you know, history major, so he says, Bill, that sounds like a lot of code.
And it is.
Yeah, trust me, Ray. Each line costs $50. Okay, do them. Can you do multiplication, McGovern? Yeah. Okay. So that's the magnitude of this thing. We worked on it for 13 years, and it allows any service or any hacker that could can use this Marble Framework tool to work in five different languages, as WikiLeaks has announced. And no one's disputed the authenticity of this release, okay? So the five languages were Russian, Chinese, Persian, Arabic, and Korean. So now, there's the story. There's the story. So I went on to RT and two other, Sputnik, and you know, one radio show and told the story. Nobody else was interested. And that's another story. But more peculiar still was the fact that the New York Times did not carry the story. All of a sudden, they became allergic to talking about this cyber tool when they had talked earlier quite freely about the one that took control of your car and made it real go fast, or, you know, thing on the TV. So there was an embargo. And this is very proof positive here that when the New York Times gets something like this, even though they have published in the series before, they go to the CIA or they go to the White House and say, gosh, this sounds really damaging. Should we publish? And they say, no. And the New York Times salutes smartly. Now, what happened? There was one person who didn't get the memo. Her name is Ellen Nakashima. She covers national security for the Washington Post. Okay. And so what does she do? She publishes. And she says, wow. Look, here's the title. Here's the headline. I've memorized the headline. Quote, WikiLeaks' latest release of CIA cyber tools could blow the cover on agency hacking operations, end quote. And she had a darn good article that included the information that the five languages were involved that I just mentioned. She didn't mention that it had been used already in 2016. Now, you remember what happened in 2016. There was an election, and there were accusations of hacking, right?
I recall. Now,
okay. So I could see why RT wanted to run this thing. And, you know, we're interested in whoever wants to know the truth. And so I was able to pass along not only my own impressions, but more important, far more important, what Bill Binney had to say about it. Now, what else? Well, in the intelligence directorate that I worked in, which was called the analysis directorate, our job was to connect dots. Our job was to fold in everything, whether it came from Megyn Kelly and Vladimir Putin, or whether it came from Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. This is just my way of saying that when Megyn Kelly interviewed President Putin, okay, he seemed, that is Putin, eager. He wanted to talk about this. He wanted to talk about issues related to the kind of cyber tools that were revealed in the Vault 7 disclosures by WikiLeaks. I guess he just wanted to tell the world that he had been briefed on this, and he knew what was going on. So what he said was this, pointed out that today's technology enables hacking to be, quote, masked and camouflaged to an extent that no one can understand the origin of the hack. And vice versa, it is possible to set up any entity or any individual that everyone will think that they are the exact source of the attack. He continued, hackers may be anywhere. There may be hackers, by the way, in the United States who are very craftily and professionally passing the buck to Russia. Can you imagine such a scenario, Megan? I can. And close to Vladimir Putin. Now, was that in the New York Times? No. Was it in the Washington Post? No. They'd got the memo by then. All I'm saying here is that there's a circumstantial case here. Now, this is not forensic, so we're not as sure about this as we are about the forensics here, that this was a leak to a thumb drive and not a hack, the DNC memos. But it's a reasonable, you know, here I'm a mystery major, right? I'm an analyst, and I say to Bill, okay, you give me this business about the 700 million lines of code. I see what has happened with respect to the New York Times being embargoed for mentioning, and they haven't mentioned it since, by the way, even after Schulte was arrested. And so, long story short here, there's a big story that can only be found in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity memos, which are on graymcgovern.com or consortiumnews.com, completely ignored by the mainstream media. And so those of your listeners who are hearing this for the first time can maybe understand that what they've been given is not the full truth on these things, and that they need to understand that, you know, when the intelligence community is so corrupted as it is now, that they will follow directions to tell the story that the powers that be want, well, they will come up with spurious evidence-free memoranda like the one of January 6, 2017, claiming that the Russians hacked, that Putin personally ordered Russian hacking into the election scenario, and that they were largely responsible for the fact that we have that clown as a president now, President Trump. You know, what could be worse to accuse people of than being responsible for having Trump in office? There's no evidence for that at all. We can prove that forensically. And now this circumstantial case, with Fault 7 being so much in the fore because of Schulte's arrest. Now, there's a footnote here.
They don't seem to have the goods on Schulte. In other words, they've had him, I think, since August of last year, for God's sake, and they've accused him of other things, the usual things, you know, sexual things, like they tried on Assange. This is part of the toolbox that they use. But they haven't.
Ray, talk about that, because you're referring to, I think they've alleged child pornography as well as some other photographs of him with a woman.
Yeah, you know, I'm the last one to defend anyone for that kind of thing. But my understanding is that he set up a big website or a big platform, and he wanted to make money, and he didn't really monitor what kinds of people were using his platform. So I think that's one of the explanations. Now, whether it's the real explanation or not, but all I'm saying is that these are the normal things like Julian Assange was accused of, and then the women that were supposed to have been involved said, no, I didn't do that. And the Swedes finally had to retract. So this is typical defamation techniques. The curious thing here is that if he's responsible for what Julian Assange called, and this is worth noting, when he released Vault 7, which included all these cyber tools and more, and he said this is a bigger disclosure than all the information that Edward Snowden brought out from NSA when he got to Hong Kong. That could not be bigger. That could not be bigger. And Julian Assange doesn't blow things out of proportion. So what we have here is a guy, apparently, that they expect had a role in giving the Vault 7 disclosures to WikiLeaks, but they can't prove it. And my guess, and I haven't talked to Bill Binney about this yet, but I know a little bit about the technology. My guess is that they don't have the traffic that they ordinarily would scoop up. You know, it's hard to believe that NSA tracks and collects all email, all telephone, all electronic traffic. I said to Bill when he told me that 2 years ago, I said, come on, Bill. He said, Ray, trust me, it's possible, and they do it. So what am I saying here? I'm saying, and this is McGovern's interpretation, connecting these dots, if they had the goods on him, if they had intercepted his computer and saw that he gave this Fold 7 stuff to Julian Assange, man, he would be, he'd be in deep isolation in the maximum security prison. So I'm reasoning, and again, this is soft analytic stuff, connecting dots. I'm reasoning that they don't have it. And the reason they don't have it is the same reason that they don't have intercepted communications proving, as they'd like to prove, that the Russians hacked the Democratic National Committee, and that's how WikiLeaks got that information. In other words, if the Russians hacked the DNC, Bill Binney and his three cohorts from NSA, who are part of our Veteran Intelligence Professional Society, say it's a sure thing that the U.S. would have intercepted that hack if it went over the Internet. And on the unlikely event that they missed it, then any of our four or five allies that have all this capability to fill in the blanks would have gotten it. So what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that my guess is that if it was Schulte, and God knows if it was or not, it could have been any of his associates who had that access. If it were he, then he would have used the time-honored procedure of copying this stuff onto a thumb drive or some other external storage device. He would have copied it and put it in this device
and gotten it to WikiLeaks. There's all kinds of ways you can do that. Just like, whoever it was got into the DNC, most likely somebody who was really ticked off at how Hillary stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders, didn't send it over the internet, but copied it onto a thumb drive and got it to Julian Assange. Now, we can prove that from forensics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Forensics.
Right. Right.
So we know that for that. But with respect to explaining why they haven't put Schulte on trial or put him away, well, there are a number of explanations. This is my best guess.
Hang on one second. Before we get there, let me ask you, he's sitting right now, I think, in federal prison in Brooklyn, and he's been there since April, and he's now claiming that they've put him in solitary confinement, that they're not allowing him to communicate with legal counsel, that the conditions that he's in, the showering conditions and all these other living conditions, are deplorable. He's even, in his letter to the judge, talked about being subjected to extreme amounts of light, so he's sleep deprivation. They're talking about him being subjected to extreme amounts of cold with wet shirts and other types of what would seem to be torture techniques. So now this letter makes it to mainstream. And I'm just wondering, this is Wilmer Leon's blind faith in American justice. Oh, my God, forgive me for that. But how does a sitting federal judge, with this letter that has now been made public, not intervene and do something to at least give the appearance that this gentleman is being treated justly?
Well, Wilmer, you made a comment about our judicial system, and I have to tell you that I come from a family of lawyers who took great pride in the law, being officers of the court. The judicial system has become almost as corrupted as Congress and the executive branch. And so these judges, and I don't know this particular one, if the CIA goes and whispers in this judge's ear and says, we believe, or we have reason to believe, that this guy is a really bad actor, that he gave all our secrets to Julian Assange, and now the Russians know all our capabilities on cyber tools. These judges are so malleable and so afraid, just as the so-called overseers in Congress of intelligence operations. They are afraid.
And the media, as you have laid out in a number of articles in RayMcGovern.com.
Yeah. So you don't get
okay.
The kind of principled judicial decisions that you used to expect. Now, the other thing I'll say is that we have a president who brags about advocating, quote, waterboarding and worse,
right,
end quote.
Mm-hmm.
We have a head of the Central Intelligence Agency who we know by CIA documents supervised the waterboarding and worse of al-Nashiri in Thailand at the first black CIA site. Our congressmen, our senators knew that, and they confirmed her anyway. So what does that tell you?
You're talking about Gina Haspel.
Yeah, Gina Haspel.
Bloody Gina, now, as you all affectionately refer to her.
Well, I was wasn't on active duty at that time.
Okay.
I will tell you this, that I was in the Senate when her nomination came up, and I was sitting there respectfully. And when the ranking Democratic member, Dianne Feinstein, said, "Now, Ms. Haspel, tell me, were you in charge of the waterboarding of al-Nashiri? Yes or no? I like you," says Steinbeck. "We get along fine. But just tell me, can you tell me whether you were in charge of the waterboarding of al-Nashiri?" And Gina Haspel said, and I was right there, Sam, "Senator Feinstein, I would love to answer that question, but it's classified." Now, the next logical question would have been,
Well, tell me, Ms. Haskell, who classified that information? And she would have had to say, well, Senator, I did. I classified all the information that was derogatory against me, and that's why we have to go into to executive session. That's when I get up. I get up, and luckily the guard between me and Haskell had been removed, and I said, excuse me, as politely as I could, but I said, you senators know the right answer to that question. She was in charge. You know that. You have it in And then for Capitol Police.
Yes, they summarily threw you out. I saw that on television.
And took me to ground, as they put it in their report. So that's how corrupt we have all three branches of our. And who did they blame for this? Well, that's the rest of the story here. And it's very important because Julian Assange has been cut off from the rest of the world. He's been put on a limited diet of some internet communication capability. People don't know this, but I do. Scaffolding has gone up all around his apartment at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. They have devices throughout the scaffolding that are pointed in. In other words, audio surveillance devices to make sure that it's even more intrusive than before. And guess what? A friend of mine from Yale tried to get in to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and there was no security there. He got in the front door. Now, when I visited Julian, there's always been people around, you know, take my passport, make sure I don't impersonate him. Nobody there. And he got all the way in, and they told him, he says, I want to see Julian. And they quickly ushered him out and said, look, here's a email. Here's an email address you can call. And, of course, it was the email address of the Ecuadorian embassy. But he didn't get very far. But he took photos of all these surveillance devices and all these puzzles. So Julian's under fire. Why is he under fire? Well, because he's responsible for two things. The United States government knows, although most of your listeners don't know, that the reason that Ed Snowden is a free man today to the degree he can be free in Russia is because of Julian Assange. They told me this directly. He said, we had to make it possible that someone leaking these kinds of documents showing gross violations of the Fourth Amendment had to escape. He couldn't be wrapped up. And so I pulled in all my chips from that part of the world. They got him out. They never thought he'd end up in Moscow. He did, but at least he's a free man and he's able to operate. That's number one. Number two, what's his most mortal sin? Well, Vault 7. And they're trying to find out how he got him. And they think they got one guy who might involve that. But as I suggested before, I think they don't have the goods on him, and they're really wondering how you can get thumb drives to Julian Assange.
So real quick then, so what happens now to Joshua Adam Schulte? Does he languish forever in American jail? I mean, at some point they got to bring him to court.
Well, you know, look what happened to Bradley Manning.
Okay.
They held him. You know, they gave him to the Marines. Now, he was an Army guy. And I guess they figured that the Army didn't know how to put the guy into dire straits. So they sent him to Quantico, and they asked the Marines, hey, would you give this guy the treatment? And they saluted smartly and did. So these people don't matter, okay? Schulte is a pawn in this thing. Whether he leaked it or not, we'll probably not know anytime soon. You can keep him in solitary confinement, which the UN has pronounced as torture, the equivalent of torture, the definition of torture. And who's going to object? Is the New York Times going to object? No, they'll run the story, but they won't object, and they won't give the significance of this. The other thing is this, that when Julian Assange released Marble Framework on the 31st of March, the head of the CIA was a fellow named Mike Pompeo.
Ah, I've heard that name before.
So he talked to all his friends, right? And he said, oh, this is terrible. This is beyond the pale. We have to. And so 13 days later, he gets up at a think tank in Washington and he says, Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks people are demons. He does believe in demons. Okay, and then he said, "This is what Julian Assange is doing. He's running a non-state hostile intelligence service, and we have to stop him." And we know that the Attorney General has said high priority to arrest Julian Assange. So what I'm saying here now is the denouement may be close. We are very afraid. That the British police, or London police, will go in there, seize Julian, send him to the United States, and he will be given the treatment that Schulte and that Bradley Manning earlier experienced. This is heinous. It makes me sad. It makes me ashamed. And that's what's afoot here. And that's the reason. That's the reason why Schulte is being treated in this really, really dubious way. But who cares? You know, when the judge says it's okay, you know, everybody's afraid of the people who might object. And those people are what we call the deep state. And I do not exaggerate.
45 seconds left. Are you afraid for your safety? And if not, why not?
Well, you know, I'm not. I just had my 79th birthday, Wilmer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in it for the duration. And I think that there are times when one has to step up. And what I would do in appealing to people my age is that my experience has been such in being carted out, beaten up by Hillary Clinton's folks and the Capitol Police. People react to that, especially when they see it mm-hmm. in video.
Right.
They don't like old people getting beat up.
Right.
And so my appeal is, if you're old like me, you have an advantage. You should put it into play. You should risk a little physical damage to yourself for the fact that the Constitution is being challenged in a way that I have never seen in these 79
Gotcha.
Years.
And let me say to you, Ray, to be 79 and you only look 78, man, you're doing great. You're doing great, Ray.
Hey, that's a
left-handed
compliment.
Hey, man, I really appreciate your time today. I know you're involved in family business. You've taken this time to give us that time, and we greatly, greatly, as always, Ray McGovern, ladies and gentlemen. And, Ray, thank you so much for coming on A Critical Hour.
You're most welcome.
Have a safe trip and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you.
All right, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.